Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment, our connections with it, and impacts upon it. I'm Chris Cherniak. Nell Larson is away. And joining me in the studio for the first part of the show is Glenn Wright. He is, among other things, Glenn, you're the county councilman with Summit County.
I am the county, one of the five county councilmen with Summit County.
That's right. And we're going to have a little conversation about, obviously, about some environmental issues and such. And we want to make sure, right up front, that this conversation, your thoughts and ideas that you share are yours.
These are my opinions, not necessarily the official policy of the county. Those, some of our comments will be addressing county policy.
Yes. Okay. All right. So let's talk a little bit. Like I said in the introduction, this conversation is kind of sort of focused around our forest, which the county, Summit County, is at least half forested in one form or another, correct?
Yes. Probably more than half forested. Almost half of the county land areas in the national forest, and we have a lot of private forests in the county. Look at the ski areas. Ski areas are essentially forested areas. If you go out to eastern Summit County, the areas bordering the national forest have a lot of forest, private forests in them.
Okay, so lots of forests, most of these evergreen types of forests, pines, firs, etc. And like I say again in the introduction, you know, in a warming world, these forests are under one form of stress or another, either based on just warmer atmospheric conditions, the weather patterns that are changing as a result, drier summers, let's say, and sometimes drier winters, although this month is no indicator of that. But over by and large, when we talked to Brian McInerney from the National Weather Service, the area is getting warmer and it's getting somewhat drier in nature. And the storms that come through are a little less frequent, but they're more intense. So all things are changing, and that's having an influence on our biosphere, which in this case is our forest here, as an example of that. So in a warmer world, we have more potential for pine beetle and bark beetle infestations, and we see a lot of that up on Mirror Lake Highway as you go up there. And a lot of deadwood, and then that leads to certain consequences. Okay, but let's take a step back first and talk about the county has some goals and aspirations with respect to their carbon footprint. And if you can just give a sense of, you know, on a qualitative level, what does that look like?
Sure. In general, our carbon footprint and renewable energy goals are that We started the process with Rocky Mountain Power and going to 100% renewable energy, both for county operations and for the county population in general. Our goals for the county are to get there by somewhere in the 2022 to 2025 time frame, and we'll be changing our goal from 2032 to 2030 for the entire county as a result of the passage of HB 411. Beyond that, we have some fairly aggressive total carbon footprint goals of an 80% reduction of our carbon footprint by 2040. Okay. And all of these things are really affected by our national forest. The forested areas in the county can either be carbon producers if we have a large fire, or carbon sinks if we manage our forests in an environmentally positive way. The forest fires, though, also have a very serious public safety and health issues behind them. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of families that live in the WUI, the wildland-urban interface, and we've got to encourage them to create clear and fire-safe areas around their homes. And adjacent to those areas, we have forested, both private and national forests, that are overgrown in the undergrowth area, where we have dying conifers. Around 80% of the conifers in our forests have been affected by some kind of infestation.
Wow.
And they're dying. We've seen over the years the great increase in severity of forest fires in the Western Mountains. And if that would come here, we could have serious consequences in our population centers, but also for our watershed. If you look at the Weber Weber Basin,
yeah.
And if you go up by Weber Canyon, we've got a lot of seasonal housing up there and some permanent housing as soon as you leave Oakley. It's right next to the National Forest. From a health and safety standpoint, that's a one-way in, one-way out road.
Right.
If you get a bed fire at the base of the of Weber Canyon, there could be a lot of people trapped
right
up there.
It's just a long cul-de-sac.
Yes. And it's the area, from a watershed standpoint, that Mountain Regional Water and Weber Basin are very, very concerned about. Because if you get a very severe fire there, you're going to have serious runoff issues into the Weber River, in the Rockport Reservoir. Scott Morrison from Mountain Regional Water has told me that under those circumstances, he'll have to shut off the intakes there for days at a time until things settle out. That will affect the water availability in the Snyderville Basin and Park City, which gets a significant amount of water from that those pump stations.
Wow. There. So there's physical, chemical, biological potential impacts with, say, an ash flow that physically blocks off mm-hmm. the flow of water into the reservoirs, the chemical impacts from the ash getting
yep.
into the water and contaminating it,
yep.
And then biological impacts, let's say, a warmer water, let's say, creates opportunities for algal blooms.
Or yeah.
So everything is in play as a result of wildfires.
Yeah.
So we don't make that direct connection between fire and water.
Yeah. And further on the wildfire, even after it settles out, I've read that the increase in evolution of nitrogen and phosphorus from the burned scar area mm-hmm. is great. So you get warmer water,
more
phosphorus, more nitrogen,
more nutrients,
more algae. I don't think we want to turn the Rockport Reservoir into what Utah Lake looks like every summer.
Which, that's true.
And that would be a disaster.
And that, yeah, because that lake is a disaster every summer as a result of high introductions of nitrogen and phosphorus, eutrophication that goes on there. So all of these things are play. So that's the wildfire potential, the watershed consequences that could occur from that. And again, it goes back to good forest management. Before we get to that, I want to talk about another issue that is kind of oddly linked to this, and that's our solid waste issue.
Yeah.
Our growing amount of solid waste. So how in the world, why would our waste that we generate have an influence on management of our carbon footprint?
Well, the reason that is important is if you look at how the forests have to be managed, we'd probably have to go in and thin out the forest and clean out a lot of the undergrowth and what's known as ladder fuels.
Mm-hmm.
And under normal circumstances in a forest, what they'll do is they'll gather them all up and they'll burn them. You'll have some controlled fires. We're looking with our solid waste plan, our future solid waste plan, to possibly build a waste energy plant, which will turn our municipal solid waste into energy. And the carbon footprint issue there is if you bury it in the landfill, it's going to turn to methane, and mm-hmm. If you process it through a waste energy plant, at least it's carbon dioxide, and you're not using some other carbon-based fuels that are have been
coal,
in the ground.
Natural gas, which
exactly.
is still the primary source of electricity
right.
in the state.
Now, if we had a waste energy plant up and running, we could take significant amounts of the undergrowth that we harvest from the forest and dead trees that we can't do anything with yet and convert those trees and energy. And that then becomes a virtuous cycle because as you take that matter out of the forest, you grow more more trees.
An opportunity for regrowth.
Right. I've talked to several people who say that our forests are greatly overgrown, not only in undergrowth, but in actual trees. And the trees are smaller and more vulnerable to disease because they're so dense. Several, both academics and forest service managers have told me that in our national forest, the density of trees is somewhere in the 150 to 180 trees per acre range. And a healthy range for our county is probably in the 30 to 50 trees per range.
Wow.
And that affects the infestation, because beetles don't travel very far, but if they've got trees that are right next to each other, they can easily munch from tree to tree.
Right.
A more spaced out forest with larger, more robust trees are less vulnerable to the infestations we've seen.
Right. That's interesting, because and we have this image that a healthy forest is one that's thick and robust in that sense.
But it's not true.
But it's not true. There's potential downsides to having a thick.
And I am not going to put myself as an expert on that issue. And so one of the things we've done is we've started to talk with the forestry department at Utah State University. They are our local experts. And I'd like them to advise us on how to come up with a plan that is environmentally sound on managing our forests. A plan that where we could thin out the forest, but also use the forest as a carbon sink and grow more healthy trees. And if we have processes in place, think about how we might use wood-based products rather than carbon and steel products to build buildings. Concrete and steel products to build buildings.
Sure. Okay. Well, let me reintroduce you, and then we'll get into that area. I'm speaking with Glenn Wright. He is Summit County Councilman, among other things, and we're here talking about, well, the county's goals and objectives with respect to their carbon footprint and how they want to reduce that carbon footprint. Basically the amount of carbon dioxide and methane and nitrous oxide and other greenhouse gases that the county operations and the county folk in general produce over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, carbon footprint issues. And then we'll also talk about how proper forest management can relate to that carbon footprint and can be a benefit to reducing that carbon footprint. And now we'll talk a little bit about how that works. And you kind of hinted in one way is like, well, one thing we can do is use more wood-based construction as part of our economy, less cement and metal, et cetera, and more wood. Okay, so harvesting, that's typical, that's classic. You also mentioned that selective harvesting of dead wood, and then that dead wood could be used as a source of energy in a waste-to-energy system that the county is exploring on
exactly.
More of a long-term basis, right? As a way of replacing or supplementing what goes into the landfill right now. So we would be burning trash and wood, dead wood, as a means of producing electricity, correct?
And not exactly burning this. Some of the technologies that are out there now are more of a gasification. It's a lot cleaner than burning in the old incineration process. You turn the biomass into a gas, and then you clean the gas before you actually burn it, and you send the gas, the syngas, through some type of generator system.
Right. Okay. So there are technologies available versus the old mass burn systems that just threw everything into a furnace, burned it, boiled water, spun turbines, and produced electricity, which, by the way, is pretty much how most of our electricity is still generated, coal, natural gas, in that sense. Okay, so using wood to generate energy, what are the challenges in having that habit? I mean, how easy is it to say to go in and selectively remove dead wood from a forest?
It is not easy at all. And there's where we come up with the economic challenge. I think initially we're going to have some funds from state and perhaps water districts to encourage, to kind of prime the economic pump to get the dead wood out of the forest and thin the forest. But that probably can't be a long-term solution. Hopefully we can find a way to make these timber activities economically viable so they're self-sustainable. Some of the dead wood actually can be used as construction purposes.
Right.
There's an outfit over in Wasatch County as you drive from Heber down towards Provo Canyon. on your left just before you hit the Deer Creek Reservoir. Mm-hmm. It's an outfit called Euclid Timber Frame, which actually takes some beetle kill lumber and cross-laminates it into heavy timber construction materials. Now, heavy timber construction materials are really very sound ways to build buildings. I think the state of Oregon has approved their use cross-laminated timber up to 16 stories. And if you think about replacing a lot of our construction above, essentially above grade, you use concrete and steel below grade, but if we were to replace a lot of that steel and concrete construction above grade with heavy timber construction, number one, we'd be sequestering that carbon in that wood for the life of the building and growing more trees in its place.
Right.
And reducing the carbon footprint of concrete and steel, which is enormous. After transportation and housing, manufacture of carbon and steel are probably the next two most prominent sources of carbon.
Greenhouse gases
and such, yes.
Okay. So there's the opportunity, and then, well, if it works here in Summit County, it could work elsewhere in other counties around the state that have similar situations.
Yeah. And it would probably be applicable to most of the counties in eastern Utah, because if you look at the map where the national forests are, virtually all of eastern Utah from north to south is part of some natural forest or national forest or another. And a lot of those counties are also our extraction counties, mm-hmm. oil and gas counties in Duchesne and Uinta County, coal counties, the Carbon Emery Sevier County area. The trends in renewable energy are gradually going to decrease the viability of those communities. We need to find jobs for the people that live there. If we could replace extraction jobs with renewable energy jobs, and including an environmentally sensitive timber industry, that could be a secret to breaking the political logjam against renewable energy. Other things we need to do. I mean, if I was the dictator of Utah, I would tell GOAD to say, we need to attract battery factories and solar panel factories for the state. The renewable energy plans that Summit County, Park City, and Salt Lake City have just by themselves are going to cause enormous increases in solar farms in southern Utah. Why not build those panels here?
Right. Well, okay. So the opportunities. With the last couple of minutes, you mentioned Utah State University, perhaps some collaboration with the counties.
What's going on? I had some very brief discussions over email with a couple of professors up there, and I asked them, can they help us design a plan that is environmentally sensitive, way to harvest wood and create a sustainable forest in Summit County? What would we have to do? How do we thin out the forest? How do we produce products that are economically viable? I don't want to just go out and wing it. My background's in engineering. I'm not a forest expert. Environmental science wasn't my field of study. But I believe in science. I want the experts to tell us, how can we do it? And how can we do it in an environmentally sensitive way?
Okay. And the last thing is that just last week, I believe, the governor signed a what's called a quote-unquote shared stewardship agreement with the Department of Agriculture to address some Forest Service management opportunities and approaches.
Right.
I don't know if you had a chance to look through that or thought, but is that
I think that's going to be an important initiative. We don't know the details of it yet, but in general, I think what it will be is that the county and the state foresters and the national foresters all get together and come up with a plan for your county on forest stewardship. Exactly how it's going to work, I don't know. Jana Young, our deputy county manager, has sent out an inquiry to the state on that. How can we get involved? I think there will be money involved. The state does have what they call watershed improvement funds out there that could be used to start the process of revitalizing our forests.
Well, it says here in this little news release, the PAC will allow the state and federal government to build on existing programs such as the governor's catastrophic wildfire reduction strategy.
Correct.
And the state of Utah's watershed restoration mm-hmm. initiative. So it potentially reaches into some different areas.
Yeah.
And that's really because it says here, it says the agreement is light on specifics, but outlines areas where the state and U.S. Forest Service can coordinate management of federal forests to mitigate risks of what we were just talking about, catastrophic wildfires, invasive species, and forest diseases.
Yeah. And I think, there's funds in that program. It's not probably enough to do the entire state. The state's going to have to set priorities. I believe Summit County should be really, right near the top of the list of priorities because with the headwaters of most of the major rivers serving the Wasatch Front coming out of Summit County, we are ground zero for forest health, or we should be.
Okay. And that's a good way to end. Summit County Councilman Glenn Wright, again, espousing your positions on these issues. This is not the county's policies or positions. We were just getting your thoughts and ideas on what we can do to better manage our forests, reduce our carbon footprint, look at different opportunities for our future economy and recreation aspects. There's a lot of value in thinking about this issue, and there's a lot of consequences and impacts if we don't.
Or if we do it wrong.
Okay. All right, we'll leave it at that then.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for joining me. And like I say, my next guest is going to be talking about some science and research that's going on to evaluate health and wellness of evergreen forests. And you're welcome to hang around for that conversation. I'm going to be speaking with Troy Magny. He's a research scientist with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory about a study that he helped co-author that really looks at the fluorescence, how evergreen forests fluoresce during the year and what that means with respect to their health and wellness. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Dr. Bob Miller here from Miller Orthodontics. My wife and I are longtime supporters of the Randy Barton Show and KPCW. We offer many options for straight teeth, including Invisalign, braces on the inside and outside of your teeth. We were on Instagram, #M2Ortho, also on Facebook or the web, m2ortho.com.
Hi, I'm Matt Mitten from Jones Waldo, supporting programming on KPCW. I provide estate planning needs from basic wills and trusts to complex trust and estate administration. Information about all our services are online at joneswaldo.com and 435-200-0085.
Do you love music as much as I do? Hi, I'm Christy Dilloway, music consultant to KPCW and a groupie for Great Grooves. I listen to music all the time, looking for the best new tracks for you, adding them to the KPCW playlist to debut as fresh tracks on Fridays. When you hear a fresh track, let me know. Do you love it? Do you hate it? Should it stay or should it go? Post a comment on the KPCW Radio Facebook page, #FreshTracks, or email Christy at kpcw.org. Together, we'll keep the KPCW playlist fresh.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak. Nell Larson is away, and joining me by phone is our second guest. He's Troy Magny. He's a research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and California Institute of Technology. And you might be wondering why we have someone from NASA joining us, Jet Propulsion Laboratory, joining us to talk about environmental issues. Well, he helped co-author a study which basically looks at the fluorescent nature of, in this case, evergreen trees, pines and firs, et cetera, and how that fluorescence relates to photosynthesis and, I guess, the overall forest health during the course of the year. So, first of all, Troy, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me and Glenn Wright this morning on This Green Earth.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for having me.
I want to let you know that I have a Glenn Wright, he's a Summit County Councilman. We were just talking about some of the issues facing Summit County with respect to the forest health here. Summit County, Troy, over half of our county is forested, and a lot of that sits in national forest land. And we have our own challenges here with the health and wellness of our forests with respect to a warming world and drought conditions and beetle kill and invasive species. So I've invited Councilman Wright to sit in on this conversation. But I know I did my best to try to introduce what this study was about. Feel free to elaborate a little more. What this study attempted to do?
Yeah, sure. I guess I'll first say the reason somebody from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory is talking to you is because we actually do a lot of earth science down there.
Yeah.
About 30% of our lab's work is working on earth science and climate-related work using satellite technologies to try to understand our atmosphere and biosphere. What we've been able to do recently, which is really exciting, and I think also, you know, within the context of forest management, is we've been able to see this sort of fluorescent glow from plants. So plants emit a tiny amount of radiation in the near infrared that we can't see directly, and that can now be seen from satellites and from sensors on the ground, and we can use that to see exactly when the forest is breathing and how much, and the magnitude and the timing of that breathing. So it's a really exciting technique, and I think, you know, in the near future it might become super applicable in the context of forest management.
So that's interesting that plants give off a little bit, like you say, a low energy infrared on the infrared scale radiation as a part of their photosynthesis activity?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, for every photon that a plant absorbs, it has a few fates. It can be used for photosynthesis, or it can be released as heat, as excess energy, and then a tiny fraction of it goes into this fluorescence part. And that's really the only part of photosynthesis we can see, and it's a tiny, tiny signal, but we can now see it. And I think it can give us a lot of clues. You've been talking about bark beetle infestation, for example, especially in Summit County. I mean, as you know, these beetles attack early on and you can't really tell with your eyes. It's the green stage of attack, right? But it does affect photosynthesis immediately, and if we can see that from space, it'll certainly improve the ability to map and detect early onset of things like bark beetle attack.
Cool. So you're seeing this from space, like you're saying, that a tree from our observation may look relatively green and healthy, but your satellites are picking up a different indicator.
Yeah, exactly. An evergreen forest, I mean, all around Utah and Colorado near you, have been a sort of grand challenge in satellite remote sensing for a long time because they're green and they retain the same amount of chlorophyll relatively throughout the entire season. So we can't really see with our eyes when these fluctuations in photosynthesis and plant function change. But now with this technique to see this glow, it's similar to when you're walking on the beach and you see the phosphorescence from sand. It's this de-excitation of electrons that produces this tiny, tiny glow. And it's incredible to me still that we can see it from space.
Yeah.
and I think it could revolutionize the way we look at forests in the future.
I have a quick question for you. This is Glenn Wright from the Summit County Council. Can your satellite images tell us when a stand of trees is essentially not sequestering carbon anymore, when it stops growing? Will these indications that you're seeing tell us that?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's on the other end of it too. You know, like a lot of these aging forests, they may still look green and healthy to us, but we can see almost immediately when a decline in photosynthesis happens and when they're basically not taking up carbon anymore and becoming more of a carbon source than a carbon sink.
So we could actually use that data in the future to harvest the trees that have stopped sequestering carbon and make room for new trees.
As a form of logging management or something.
Logging management and carbon and future carbon sequestration.
Right. Yeah, I think that's an awesome application. And the technology is getting better with newer satellites that have come up that we can really improve the resolution both in time and in space of this measurement. And I think, you know, even though it's a very early stage of this type of science, we're really beginning to understand what we can and cannot do with it. And I think what you mentioned here is actually a great application.
So talk about these satellites, because are these satellites that were specifically sent up to do this, or were these satellites that were already up there and you find out this information because they were maybe doing something else?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think that's a really cool part of this story, is that it's completely serendipitous. These satellites were never designed to measure fluorescence. They're actually measured to design atmospheric gases. And in order to do so, you need a really, really fine spectral resolution. So you need to be able to break up the electromagnetic spectrum into very, very, very narrow wave bands. And, you know, we were able to use this information in these tiny wave bands to see this fluorescent glow from plants. And it was accidental. And I will say, you know, after some of the first discoveries of this technique using atmospheric gas measuring satellites, the European Space Agency has now funded a satellite that will launch in 2022, I think, or 2023, designed explicitly to measure fluorescence from plants. And that has applications across forests and croplands and really understanding the terrestrial biosphere as a whole.
What kind of spatial determinations can you get on that? What's your granularity?
Yeah,
so this is where you might cringe a little bit as a forest manager, because right now it's quite coarse. So like the best we can do is about 1.2 by 2 kilometers. And the best repeat time we can get is with the satellite that can produce about weekly resolution. So, you know, it's coarse in time and space. It's nothing like, say, your Landsat imagery that is often used in forest management. But I think that as we improve the retrievals and we can get more signal for the noise, I think we can begin to improve that resolution. But, you know, that's still, I think, at that resolution, they're big pixels. But like you said, if you want to see a large swath of forest that may not be photosynthesizing anymore, not taking up carbon, it's still, I think, super valuable.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Troy Magny. He's a research scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and California Institute of Technology. We're talking about a study that he helped co-author that just was, well, I think it was released just yesterday or today, looking, among other things, at how plants fluoresce or otherwise glow, and how satellites are able to pick up that fluorescence and give a sense of the forest's health and wellness. There's another thing that seems to be part of this study, Troy, and that's how plants generate or produce a type of sunscreen during the winter to help to protect them from ultraviolet light. What do I have that right?
Yeah, that's okay. Exactly right. Yeah, I've been pushing that analogy for a while, but I think it's a good one because, as I said earlier, a lot of these forests retain chlorophyll, which of course is the pigment responsible for photosynthesis all throughout the year, and that's why to our eyes they appear green. But in the winter, the plants don't have any means to do photosynthesis because it's cold and they can't transport water. So what they do is they actually shuffle around some pigments within the needle called xanthophyll pigments. And I like to sort of, you know, think of that as sunscreen, effectively. Yeah. So the plant is saying, hey, there's still a lot of light. I mean, as you know, in Utah and Colorado, you know, you're still getting a lot of light in these forests in the winter, but the plant needs a way to protect itself. So it produces these tiny little pigments, cycles these pigments around to reflect that, or basically dissipate that energy away. And see that, but that's a, that's a different topic and it's a different signal, but it's very linked to fluorescence.
Right. And a listener just texted in. They have a question that wants to know. I know we focused on evergreens, pines and firs, and that's what we've been talking about mostly. But does this fluorescence show up for all types of trees, deciduous and coniferous trees and plants?
Yeah. In fact, every flora in the plant kingdom fluoresces. So, you know, the applications are widespread. This study was focused on evergreen forests because they've been a big challenge for such a long time. But like I was mentioning that satellite earlier that the European Space Agency is now funded to launch, a big application of that was crops. So being able, like precision agriculture, helping farmers understand the timing and location of decreases in photosynthesis as sort of a management tool to then go to a part of a field and say, okay, what's going on here? Do we have a pest infestation? Mm. Is it, you know, what's causing this decrease in photosynthesis? So, yeah, there's a widespread application for it.
Right.
I think.
Another question on the granularity of your of this study. Are there handheld units or portable units that could be taken into the forest to supplement some of the information you're getting? You know, say if you find a 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer area that's not sequestering carbon anymore, are there handheld units that we can take into the forest and
measure,
essentially measure tree by tree?
Yeah, exactly. Oh. And in fact, the plant physiologists and plant biophysicists were onto this fluorescence way before we were. They've been measuring it at the needle and leaf scale for decades, and they've been doing it with handheld instruments. Uh-huh. They've become an extremely valuable tool in understanding plant health and plant productivity, but they've never been able to scale it beyond the needle or the individual leaf. And that's really the big advance here, is now that we can see this across the globe. But you're right, exactly. And that would be a great tool. And that's what we do in this study, as well as we use these instruments, small-scale fluorimeters, they're called, to validate the satellite signal.
And of course, I can't help but think of how drone technology could help supplement that research, too, by low-level flights across large swaths, square miles of forest, and get an image of...
absolutely.
Yeah. So lots of opportunities to combine technologies. You know, one's chocolate, well, another's peanut butter, and have a great taste in candy. So it's really interesting because I was also thinking about, as we see in a warmer world, we actually may see expansions of plant activity, say, northward. And this is a way of mapping forest, perhaps forest expansion or species types of expansion, because different species may give off a different fluorescence. And maybe there's a way of mapping growth in that sense.
Yeah, exactly. And that was, what you've just outlined was the basis for a proposal that NASA just funded of ours through their Arctic Boreal.
I was just a little late with that. Oh, okay. So yeah. This is the next step to another area of research.
Yeah, so we're trying to use it to understand how the large swaths of the boreal forest are responding to climate change. And greening is the term that has been used in our community anyways, the greening of the north, and in some cases the browning.
Right. And then of course you can also see the footprint of deforestation that's going on, say, in South America or along the equator, et cetera. I mean, it's just a fantastic way of taking, the planet's, not necessarily the planet's temperature, but the planet's picture.
That's exactly it, yeah. So yeah. Taking the pulse of the biosphere, I like to think of it.
Yeah. So, Troy, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people go to perhaps, read this paper and learn more about the research you're doing?
So the paper will come out in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences this week, but actually NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory website has some nice articles and resources that can help you understand what this signal is and what it might do for you.
And while I got another minute, you said that some 30% of Jet Propulsion Laboratory research is spent, you know, exploring environmental issues. Are you working on other environmental research?
Yeah, it spans the globe, really. We have folks in our group looking at, like you said, deforestation in the Amazon, carbon sequestration in the rainforest, very applied work in cropping systems, looking at large-scale droughts. It's trying to really put the puzzle pieces together to understand our global carbon cycle, and that's a big part of what our group's working on.
And, of course, I'm going to assume that all this research is funded on a federal level in one form or another?
That's correct, yep.
Okay. All right. Yep. Well, I won't go any further there, but lots of luck with all your work you're doing and all the hopeful funding that you get to do this important work. Again, is there a website that people can go to learn more about what the Jet Propulsion Lab is doing?
Yeah, jpl.nasa.gov, and you can play around on there, and certainly you'll stumble across some of this newer fluorescent work there. And the OCO2 mission in particular is sort of leading this effort, the Orbiting Carbon Observatory.
Orbiting Carbon Observatory. All right. Well, again, this what's amazing about this, Troy, is that you say there's a serendipitous nature behind the discovery of how satellites can provide or information about our planet's environment. And good luck to some more serendipitous work.
Thank you. It's been great to talk to you.
Yeah, same here. Thanks a lot, Troy. Let's take a break for some underwriters. And when I come back, I got a couple of news items I want to cover. One thing is actually one of the most effective ways you can reduce your carbon footprint right now. It's this green earth. I'll be right back.
Hi, this is Steve Roney Jr. from Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. Good. We are a proud supporter of KPCW and our Park City community. Our agents are located in Summit and Wasatch counties, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com or 649-7171.
Hi, this is Bill Rock. The Vail Epic Promise Foundation, a nonprofit organization, is a proud supporter of KPCW. The foundation provides Park City Mountain employees with grants in emergencies and for educational purposes. Information is available to Park City Mountain employees at epicpromise.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on the environment, our connections with it, and impacts upon it. I'm Chris Cherniak. Now Larson is away. And I emphasize impacts upon our environment because this next story is just about that, how we as individuals affect our environment and what we can do to reduce our carbon and ecological footprint. And here's how you do it. The meat and dairy industry accounts for around 14.5%, let's say 15% of the world's greenhouse gases each year. That's roughly the same amount as the emissions from all the cars, trucks, airplanes, and ships combined in the world. Okay, that's the meat and what the meat and dairy industry produces in terms of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, some nitrous oxides, etc. Now, in general, beef and lamb have the biggest climate footprint per gram of protein, while plant-based foods tend to have the smallest impact. No surprise there. Pork and chicken are somewhere in the middle. A major study published last year in the journal Science calculated the average greenhouse gas emissions associated with different foods. Wild fish often have a relatively small climate footprint, with the main source of emissions being the fuel burned by fishing boats. So one recent analysis found that a number of popular wild fish, anchovies, sardines, herring, tuna, pollock, cod, haddock, have on average a lower carbon footprint than chicken or pork or beef or lamb. Mollusks like clams, oysters, and scallops also are a low carbon choice, great low carbon choice. On the other hand, what's interesting, wild shrimp and lobster can have a larger impact than chicken or pork because pulling them in, harvesting wild shrimp and lobster, demands extra fuel for the fishing boat. So yes, we have a challenge here living in the mountains that, of course, any fish we eat here, or mollusk or lobster, et cetera, has a larger relative carbon footprint because it travels such a large, long distance. But overall, the story is, the takeaway, if you really want to do something about your carbon footprint, really try to reduce the amount of meat and dairy that you consume on a daily or weekly basis. Do what you can to cut back on eating beef and chicken and lamb and pork, etc. There's good reasons for that, carbon and maybe even ethical reasons why we should reduce our meat and dairy consumption and replace it with a plant-based diet. So 15% of the world's greenhouse gases are introduced by the meat and dairy industry on an annual basis. All right, that's one story. I got a couple minutes for one more. This is about the state of Utah, skin cancer, melanoma cancer in particular. Utah has consistently ranked as the highest state nationally in terms of melanoma death and incidence. Over time, melanoma cancer mortality rates and U.S. trends remained steady. From 2009 to 2014, melanoma death rates were significantly higher in Utah compared to the national rate, roughly 10% higher. Now, why do we have is our risks of skin cancer higher up here in Utah? Well, I just kind of gave it away. Up here, when you live at 7,000 and 8,000 and 9,000 feet, you're going to be exposed to more ultraviolet radiation. In some ways, yeah, you're closer to the sun, so there's less atmosphere between you and the sun and its ultraviolet rays. Our bluebird skies, lend itself to being having greater exposure time to the sun. And what's interesting is that when you're up here in the mountains, the sun can be very intense, but it's not that warm. So you don't have the typical cues that you might get if you're down at the beach, where it's not only the sun is somewhat intense, but it's also hot and you sweat. And then those cues give you a sense like, ooh, I need some protection from the sun, or I need to get out of the sun. So I've seen people at the pool who are baking like potatoes, who don't realize how much sun they're getting and how burned they're getting, because it's 75 or 76 or 77. It just doesn't feel that hot, but it is. And so we need to protect ourselves from the sun every day as best we can up here. All right. It's time to wrap things up. Again, I want to thank our guest first, Glenn Wright, Summit County Councilman. and Troy Magny, research scientist with NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory and the California Institute of Technology. Also, let's thank our underwriters and sponsors who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah, Vail Resorts Epic Promise, Rocky Mountain Power, Jones Waldo, Attorneys at Law, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, San Francisco Design, and of course, always, listeners like you. We're always interested in getting your thoughts and ideas and suggestions for topics and stories that we could cover here on This Green Earth. You can forward those thoughts and ideas and comments to our email, that is thisgreenearth, all one word, at kpcw.org. Remember, this is KCPW 91.7 FM in Park City. Remember, we've got your Wasatch back. And again, want to thank you for joining us, joining me this morning. And we'll see you all next week. Coming up is NPR News. And we'll see you then.